Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. After a very brief bout with cancer on Wednesday, President Biden tested positive for COVID on Thursday.
Hey-o!
By the way, he was supposed to cure cancer, so it shouldn't even be a topic of conversation, if you recall. That was his charge as
Vice President.
The final days of the Joe Obama first two terms. So now we've completed the troika, the COVID troika, Fauci, Biden, Pritzker.
Schumer, Chuck, don't forget Chuck Schumer. Double vax, double boosted, you know.
Yeah, I'll stick with my trick. And come up with your own.
The headlines were two powerful political politicians have COVID. Mm. And then they showed us, you know, split screen with Pritzker and Biden, but, you know.
Biden posted a video message to the American people to make sure you know that his work continues. He's going to be all right.
Hey, folks, guess you heard this morning I tested positive for COVID. But I've been double vaccinated, double boosted. Symptoms are mild, and I really appreciate your inquiries and your concerns. But I'm doing well. I'm getting a lot of work done. I'm going to continue to get it done. And in the meantime, thanks for your concern and keep the faith. It's going
to
be okay.
Keep on trucking. Yeah, keep on trucking.
But
work,
Dan,
is what they do every day. That's just what they do.
Not wearing a mask. He has COVID. He's in front of a photographer. Unmasked. People had a problem with that. Peter Alexander asked the question on NBC.
Should Americans who are positive for COVID, if they are in public or in any place at any time, always wear a mask?
So the CDC guidance on this is clear. People should isolate and they should, if they're going to be in close contact with anybody else, they should definitely be wearing a mask. The president was more than 6 feet away from the camera person who was wearing an N95. So I think it was, from a safety point of view, very safe thing to do.
Great. Yeah. Wonderful.
For 2.5 years, if you test positive, you have to isolate. You have to wear a mask. Mm-hmm. Don't be around anybody. Mm-hmm. That's all right. Joe Biden was with children in Detroit at a school yesterday.
He's doing fine. He's feeling good. I tested negative this morning. I am going to keep my schedule. I am, according to CDC guidelines, I am keeping masked.
If any Republican did that, are you kidding me? Come on. When Trump got back from the hospital after he had COVID, remember he was on the balcony and waved? The left lost their mind saying he's not wearing a mask, even though he was outside as well.
Yeah, the mask thing's sort of been done to death. If you aren't interested in the many studies that have been authored on the topic of masks and their efficacy, then I don't think we're going to convince you at this point. If you're just going to rinse and repeat whatever you hear from the flax for the CDC, then there's just no getting to you. But something else came up yesterday, another aspect of the response, the COVID response. Mm-hmm. And that was contact tracing.
Oh.
Karine Jean-Pierre, the quadruple threat, was asked if there's any idea where Biden got COVID, and this was her initial response.
I don't think that matters, right? I think what matters is we prepared for this moment.
It doesn't matter. Then there was a follow-up on the same question, he got it. Philip Wegman from RealClearPolitics.com. It doesn't matter. Is there going to be contact tracing?
You were asked about your earlier statement that it didn't matter where he picked this up. Obviously, the most important thing is how the president is doing in the here and now.
Yeah.
But will you let us know if you do figure out where the president did pick up this virus? I mean, it certainly does matter, at least for history.
Well, as you know, the president travels, right? He travels a lot. He engages with a lot of people.
Uh-huh.
Again, what I was trying to say and what I was wanting to be sure that we understood is, again, the here and now. Like right now, we are explaining to you how he's feeling, how he's doing. You've heard from him directly. We're going to continue to do that. We are going to do, contact tracing as far as who he was around these past 48 hours, as Dr. Jha just laid out. But it is, it is not the easiest thing, right, to find out exactly where someone got COVID. Oh. I do not know when I got COVID. I have no idea who I got it from.
I dozed off for a second there, but I woke up in time for the part about we're going to do contact tracing, but it's very difficult to find out where somebody got COVID. So then explain to me the tens and hundreds of billions of dollars of funny money that was printed and drop shipped to states and localities to do these ridiculous contact tracing programs that were knocking hundreds of kids out of school at a time.
Yeah, they put them on red lists. And I know because one of my son was on the red list and I had to fight like HE double hockey sticks to get him off the red list. And they were relentless. They were disgusting human beings. They were asking personal questions that they had no business, had nothing to do with COVID. And they made a livelihood out of that. And that's what's, he could have gotten it from Mohammed bin Salman when he was in Saudi Arabia. Maybe that fist pump. Maybe that was their plan to get, because they are enemies, to try to get Biden sick with COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
If only it transmitted by skin-to-skin contact.
No, I know, but
doesn't.
I'm saying, but there could have been somebody in the room who was positive. Who knows?
Whatever. You put everybody, the country, through the ringer on this contact tracing, this futile contact tracing gambit, and spent, again, hundreds of billions of dollars that we didn't need to print and didn't need to spend, and that's sort of relevant in this inflationary environment we find ourselves in. And now, hey, it's tough. It's tough to figure it out. Yeah, I know. Some people said that at the time, and we were not serious about saving lives when we said that at the time. How is that actually going to work? How do you actually trace it back?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
We had Brian Westbury on the show yesterday, and he called the lockdown of the U.S. economy the worst public policy decision in the history of free markets. And I think he's probably right about that. I can't think of a more catastrophic decision. Every aspect of the response to COVID, is there a single one other than the development of a vaccine that is an unalloyed good, or that actually, rather than saying it that way, that actually was counterproductive, that was a waste of time and money, that stopped nothing, that helped no one? Any aspect, sans the development of the vaccine and therapeutics to actually treat the virus. All this other stuff, this is politician cosplay with epidemiologists.
It was a side hustle, a second job for a lot of people.
Glenn on the South Suburbs.
A contact tracer.
Yeah, just a comment on yesterday's press conference. Unlike inflation, the administration's transparency is transitory. We answer nothing, respond to everything. Has anyone seen Dr. O'Connor?
Dr. O'Connor? Who's Dr.
That?
O'Connor?
The president's physician.
Oh, yeah.
The one they asked to have speak to personally, live, not through a letter.
He had Brown University's Dr. Jha there, the COVID point guy for the administration now. I don't even know who Biden's doctor was because, what's the point? Jim in Crown Point.
It's amazing. The three most important people, the face of the Democratic Party, is Biden, Harris, and Jackie Cousteau. They're all incoherent. How the hell could you can't make sense of anything they say. And that doctor, rather than explain the condition of the president, they all stressed how hard he's been working. He's not doing anything. And if I was a Republican doing a commercial for the next go around, I would put Kylie McEnany next to Jackie Cousteau. The difference is staggering.
Who's Jackie Cousteau? I don't. Oh, you're talking. That's your Karine Jean-Pierre.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
I forgot her name for a minute here.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah, I mean, whatever. I mean, comparing press secretaries is completely irrelevant and it doesn't move any votes. It's nonsensical. But I will say this. Corinne Jean-Pierre is completely over her skis in that job.
Yeah, and she's not getting any better. Normally, after the first month, you kind of pick up on it, and it's getting worse.
Jen Psaki is not intelligent, and she is a professional prevaricator. Corinne Jean-Pierre is just clueless and incoherent.
It's painful to watch those.
But to Jim's point, I mean, how is that any different than the people for whom she speaks, Kamala and the big guy?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
President Trump's statement on Joe Biden testing positive for COVID.
Yeah.
Joe Biden, who many have said is our worst president, has come down with a case of the China virus despite being vaccinated. I hope Sleepy Joe is able to bounce back quickly, much as I was. Doctors describe my fight against the China virus as Herculean, and not meaning the woke Disney Hercules, but rather the Kevin Sorbo one, the Lou Ferrigno one as well. Joe, I wish you a speedy recovery, even though you are taking America in the wrong direction. No one wants Kamala.
Was that on Truth Social?
It's actually not. It's a spoof statement.
Oh.
It's a spoof statement.
But I actually believe that he would have written that.
When it first came over the transom, I thought it was real, too, because it sounds like something he would do, and it would have been great if he had, because it's hilarious.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Cigar Night with Dennis Prager, Dan Proft, and Sean Thompson on Thursday, August 18th. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. All of a sudden, some on the left are feeling the local impacts of lawlessness at the southern border. New York City Mayor Eric Adams demanding federal government help to pay for what he said is a wave of asylum seekers pouring into the city, claiming its safety net in New York City being strained by busloads of people coming from border states and elsewhere.
Well, too bad. You reap what you sow.
Adams saying in a statement, currently New York City is experiencing a marked increase in the number of asylum seekers arriving from Latin America and other regions. In some instances, families are arriving on buses sent by Texas and Arizona governments, while in others, it appears that individuals are being sent by the federal government. The governors, Ducey and Abbott of Arizona and Texas, respectively, said no buses of asylum seekers have been sent by the state governments, their state governments. That's a lie.
Okay.
It's the federal government? Sure. Did Greg Abbott send a bus of asylum seekers to Washington, D.C.? He did, but not to New York. So you got other problems. And the problem, of course, is that there is no security at the southern border. There is a Olay approach to allowing people in this country and then actually using federal government resources to spread them out around the country. And Eric Adams is starting to feel it.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
And then you have this this issue that has been reintroduced. It was reported on early in the year, but it's been reintroduced in part because of this exchange between Josh Hawley and the TSA administrator, David Pekoske, Senate hearing about TSA policy that allows illegal immigrants to use warrants.
What?
As an alternative form of identification.
Is there a picture on the warrant?
Here is that exchange.
How many individuals have presented TSA with arrest warrants or deportation notices and were permitted to travel in this calendar year?
Under 1,000, sir.
How does this policy comport with 18 U.S.C. 1325, which criminalizes improper entry into the United States by an alien?
Sir, these individuals that have these arrest warrants, those arrest warrants were issued by the Border Patrol or a customs officer, and they serve as a beginning to our identity verification process. So you can't walk up to a checkpoint, waive that form, and then you go right through into screening. We go through a process to verify that you are the person that you claim to be, and that you are receiving the level of screening, which always includes enhanced screening when people don't have the proper identification.
So if somebody who presents an arrest warrant is subject to an in-person interview with the airport's federal security director?
They have an interview with the officers that are on scene at the checkpoint, but that's not all that's happening. What those officers are doing are they're talking to...
Wait, when you say the officers on scene at the checkpoint, what are we talking about?
The transportation security officers, the uniformed officers at the checkpoint.
Okay, but not the federal security director.
They will bring in the federal security director if needed.
Well, why would that person not be needed if you have someone who's an illegal immigrant?
Right. So we aren't looking at whether a person is legal or illegal in the country. Our function is to make sure that...
Why not?
Because our role is to make sure that people that might pose a risk to transportation that's significant enough to either require enhanced screening or to not allow them to fly... that the proper.
So your position is someone who is known to have violated the laws of the United States does not thereby need enhanced screening? You're not concerned about this person as a security threat?
Sir, there are people every day that violate the laws of the United States that fly. We look for things that are related to transportation security.
And you don't think someone who is by definition, mm-hmm. somebody presents a warrant for arrest, mm-hmm. you don't think that necessitates enhanced screening?
They get enhanced. All of those individuals get enhanced screening.
You just told me that it doesn't necessarily involve... any interview with the federal security director, and you also said that you may well let them get on airplanes. And in fact, you've allowed at least 1,000 people to get on airplanes this year, calendar year alone.
Right,
it's just baffling. You know, I remember, I'm old enough to remember 9/11. And I remember after 9/11, part of standing up the Department of Homeland Security and part of the assessment in terms of how the federal government failed to prevent 9/11 was the lack of communication and coordination between law enforcement agencies, both within the federal government as well as up and down federal to state and local. And yet what you hear from TSA is, you know, we're narrowly interested in transportation only, you know, whether or not they can travel on a plane, but we aren't interested in coordinating or cooperating with other law enforcement agencies to ensure that somebody who has violated the law, there's an arrest warrant that they presented, or is alleged to have violated the law.
Right.
Number one, doesn't flee the jurisdiction. Number two, that whatever law enforcement agency is controlling with that person's charges is notified of their movement. No. We just say if it's a valid, we accept it as a valid alternative form of ID, and then we just let people travel commercially as they see fit, like anybody else, except they're not an American citizen, so it's not like anybody else.
I mean, the TSA is rewarding criminal behavior. Why aren't they doing their job? And he acts so nonchalantly, you know, so ho-hum about the whole thing. It's not a big deal.
This issue has been subordinated, the border security issue has been subordinated to inflation and public safety, although it's certainly related to public safety, but, you know, domestic right. public safety.
And the kitchen table issue. Right
but there. But this certainly informs it. I mean, we know about the number of illegal immigrants who've killed Americans while they were in this country illegally. They should have never been there. Those Americans should not have died. We've profiled many of those stories. But there's this, too, just sort of the general lackadaisical attitude or even promotion of people who have committed crimes or are wanted for crimes enjoying all the rights and privileges of American citizens, and in some cases seemingly enjoying extra citizenship rights as compared to American citizens. You got jurisdictions that want them to be able to vote. You've got complete unfettered access to welfare benefits. And again, as we've talked about this topic so many times over the years, I'm a pro-legal immigration Republican. I disagree with Tom Cotton on artificial caps. I'm all for beacon of hope and opportunity, people the world overcoming. But you have to have a system that is sensible, that is fair, and that is enforced. And we have none of that. And with the left, and I think some on the center right, there's just no interest in this. There's no political will to address this. This is lunacy.
And what also infuriated Americans was up until July or June 12th, you had to provide a negative test to get back into the country from Mexico, but yet you could cross over and not get tested. You didn't, you know, there's different rules for different groups of people. It was easier for illegals to get into this country than American citizens to get back.
Yeah, and there's all sorts of layers to the issue of border security and immigration. But it just seems to me this simple one that I always go back to. Like, if you cannot see your way fit to remove people from this country who are here illegally and commit crimes while they're here illegally, then there's just nothing else to talk about. That is a threshold level question. If the answer is, no, I don't have the political will, no, I don't, I have no interest in that, well, then we have nothing to discuss. And we need more people in positions of policymaking that with whom we do have something to discuss, because they at least clear that threshold level question. Right now, you have a political ruling class in D.C. that does not. Tom in Oswego, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Every time this subject comes up, my blood just starts boiling. I have a son-in-law who's a Mexican citizen, married to my daughter, with a one-year-old baby now in Puerto Vallarta. He cannot get a visa to come over just to visit. It is so ridiculous. And we are letting in literally the size of Houston every year and a half. And we don't know where these people are.
Yeah, right.
We say they do, but we don't. And me personally, I think a lot of these officials, right up to Biden, they should all be arrested for accessories to a crime. This is ridiculous. And I don't think people realize exactly what's happening. We're a big country, so we can absorb a lot of, crap. But once pretty soon, that crap's going to become so much, just like in Washington and New York, it's going to start affecting everybody. But by that time, the camel's, the camel's get his nose in the tent. It's going to be too late.
So with
really approaching that point.
With your son-in-law, so what is the, is it just a bureaucracy thing in terms of the holdup for him to get a visa to visit?
Yeah, fortunately, my grandson is a dual citizen. They had to go to Guadalajara. They give all kinds of paperwork. My son-in-law just got his passport, which took forever. That means he can travel in countries that don't require a visa. But his appointment is for October of 2023, just to get an appointment to be screened to come into the country. And then, of course, you have to meet all types of criteria. They don't really want to let the producers go. He's a business person. They have a house there. They want to keep those people there. See, and I hate to say this. I employ Mexican people. I have nothing wrong with Mexican people. I love them. But we have to have a legal system.
Of course.
This is breaking down really fast. And again, when I turn the television on and I see President Biden up there, laughing, and they're all chuckling about this. And who is it? Mayorkas says the border's secure. I swear they should be arrested.
Yeah.
This is really bad.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Thanks.
We'll have to maybe get an update from Kamala on how she's done solving the root causes of mass illegal immigration coming from Northern Triangle countries up through Mexico. Yeah,
that was her homework assignment.
I haven't heard a status report on for a while. Interesting. But I mean, that's the thing. It's just it's so illustrative of D.C. and big blue state governance. People who play by the rules. Tom from Oswego's son-in-law.
Yep.
People play the rules. They get, the runaround. They have to go through all kinds of hoops. You come over illegally.
You don't have to test for COVID.
Whatever you feel like.
No, then they give you phones, and they're supposed to be tracking them on their phones to know where they are, which is a joke.
That Mayorkas, I mean.
I mean, that's a
that,
joke.
That I mean, and it starts, I mean, the leadership matters. It starts, obviously, at the top, but right below that is that Ali Mayorkas, who's a complete doofus. Josh in Fresno, California.
Hello, I'm just calling to let you guys know that the Constitution of the United States doesn't grant the federal government any authority to control immigration. And where you can find this at would be Thomas Jefferson's Kentucky Resolutions of 1798 and James Madison's Report of 1800, where they were both combating John Adams's Aliens and Seditions Act.
Yeah, well, okay, thanks for the call, Josh, but no, there is reference in the Constitution to the power of Congress to, quote, exclude aliens from the United States and to prescribe the terms and conditions on which they come in. The power of Congress in this regard is absolute. So, yeah, it is in the Constitution. It is a constitutional power conferred to the federal government, which is why states' hands are tied to some extent. Although, you know, raising the flag on the local impacts is not a bad idea, even if Eric Adams was only sort of half right. Of course, would we ever hear Lori Lightfoot?
Oh.
Offer the same? Or any alderman here? No. No. And
sanctuary state, a sanctuary county, exactly. Sanctuary city.
Sanctuary state.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, yeah. Illinois.
And then yeah, the
yeah,
county
yeah.
And then, yeah.
Right.
Because
no.
We have to have three layers of it, just in case, you know, there's a crack somewhere.
People who play by the rules getting fleeced and put in harm's way by a government they finance. That's the story here.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So, I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week we talked about this incredible incident in St. Paul, Minnesota, where a toddler, like in a diaper, was out on a street corner accosting St. Paul police officers and trying to punch them in their knees.
A little ankle biter. And he had a mouth on him, and this is a four-year-old.
Shut up, bitch!
Shut up,
little
kid!
Go! What's that,
little ugly
ass? What you got, little ugly
ass? I'm frying his deep-fried Oreo head.
So this little boy is wildly swinging at St. Paul police, calling him bitch and so on and so forth. And just
saying, you're ugly.
The obvious point is, where did he learn that?
He didn't learn that from television. That is behavior that is happening at home.
Well, that pales in comparison to what happened in Utah. Police responding to a McDonald's because a man who had a disagreement with his order brandished a gun in the drive-thru. So they show up and demand that he get out of the car. He resists. He doesn't do it at first. And then they drag him out of the car. And it goes down like this.
Get out of the car. Get out of the car. Let me see your hands. Open your window. Open the door. Open the door. Okay. Open the door, real slow. Okay, put down your phone. Put down your phone. With your right hand. With your right hand, open the door. Open the door. Open your door. Come on out. Come on out.
Hold on, I got my...
Hold
get
on.
Get out!
Get out of the car.
Down!
Gun! Gun! Gun!
Get your arm out!
Get your arm out!
Get your arm out now!
No! Drop the gun!
Nobody's hit.
That's it.
You all right? Hey, hey.
Let's go for it.
Yeah. No, we need medical. Get us medical. He went unresponsive.
So when he got pulled out of the car, Dad got pulled out of the car and put to the ground to be put in cuffs. Remember, he brandished a gun in the drive-thru at McDonald's because he had a disagreement over the order. He gets pulled out. He gets put in cuffs. There's a 3- and a 4-year-old. Two kids in the back seat of his car, and the 4-year-old points a gun at the officer. According to a local report, the officer used his hand to sweep the gun away, and the gun went off, hitting the upper part of the McDonald's building. The officer then yelled at the person inside of the car to drop the gun, and after looking inside the car, realized it was a small child.
A 4-year-old boy who was sitting next to his 3-year-old sister. And according to KSL-TV, they said the investigation showed that the father, quote, told the child to shoot at the police.
The child told police, quote, I grabbed my dad's gun and tried to shoot the police so he could be free to do what he wanted. The 4-year-old also told police he shot the gun because, quote, he wanted his daddy back. And he told police that his dad had told him the police officer cannot open the door. The report is Johnson instructed the child to shoot at officers. And we also find out this is not the first time that his 4-year-old son had gotten a hold of a gun. What? Alexis Davis, his wife and the mother of the child, said in February of this year, it kind of brought me to my knees because he put a loaded weapon in my 4-year-old's hand. That was in February. In March, Johnson was charged with child abuse, aggravated assault, and interference with an arresting officer. He had told police, the dad here, that he blacked out for 30 seconds after he began arguing with the McDonald's employee over the fast food order. He denied brandishing the firearm, but surveillance video has him
brandishing the firearm. Yeah. I mean, he's ordered to spend 120 days in jail, followed by 3 years of probation, as well as anger management and parenting courses. They say he no longer is able to own a firearm. What he said in court, quote, I would like to apologize for my actions on that day. It was a very stupid mistake that I should have never made.
Apology not accepted.
Nope. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment.
This sounds like, is DCFS here doing contract work in Utah?
Was he passing by?
He put a gun in his 4-year-old's hand in February. He was charged with child abuse, aggravated assault, interference with an arresting officer. And here we are back in, and we've had this happen again.
And he's, he's already out of jail now. He was ordered to spend 120 days. That was
not the first time, according to the father himself, not the first time his son had gotten a hold of a gun. So after those charges in February, how does he still have custodial rights with that kid? And also, too,
the mom's still with him.
I guess she is. Yeah, I guess they characterize her as his wife, not ex-wife. So, yeah, I guess she is. Yeah.
Women, wake up. Hello. God, I mean.
So you want to,
I don't even know where to start. Because it could have been so much worse. The cop could have gotten killed. or somebody in the restaurant at McDonald's easily could have gotten killed.
Or the little girl in the back seat, anybody. But
and she was crying.
The point is, where does this come from? Let's ban sport rifles. Let's do this. Let's do that. Raise the age for this and raise the age for that and prohibit this and prohibit that. When you're talking about the very small fraction of Americans who are responsible for the preponderance of violent crime, particularly in big cities, but not limited to big cities, this is what you're talking about. Stories like the one out of St. Paul, stories like this out of Utah. Yeah, they're anecdotes and they're one-offs. But until we get serious about the sort of culture that exists within pockets of America's population, particularly its urban population, then you're not serious about doing anything about violent crime. There's nobody that would defend what that guy did. And then what's going to happen to him? Well, what did happen to him? He was charged with child abuse, aggravated assault, and interference with an arresting officer in February, and he's at the McDonald's drive-thru in July. I mean, in March, I should
March.
Say. March,
yeah,
he was charged.
It's even worse.
And he's at the McDonald's drive-thru there in July.
Loaded, ready to go.
Which is
they messed up my order. I said supersize fries.
Which is consistent. Lee Zeldin, you've heard Mike Scott reporting on this all morning so far, who was attacked at a campaign stop.
Last night in New York and Rochester.
By some 43-year-old dude attacked with a knife at a campaign stop. He's a member of Congress. He's running for governor. He's a Republican nominee for governor in New York. And the man who attacked him, Arroard, released on his own recognizance. But we're serious.
Oh, there you go.
We're very concerned. You hear the left talk about the civility of our discourse and very concerned about political disagreements bubbling over into political, politically motivated violence. Arroard in upstate New York attacking a congressman and the Republican nominee for governor with a knife.
And good Samaritan knocked him over.
Yeah, but Zeldin had to essentially dodge the attacker when he first lunged at him, and then some AMVETS guy tackled the guy. I don't know what you say. You have to report. I mean, I feel compelled. We have to report these stories like the ones in St. Paul and the ones in Utah. So you get a sense of the depths of depravity that exist. And you also have an appreciation for how insincere and ineffective what you hear from politicians really is. Naperville City Council this week talking about sport rifles. And if you don't support the ban on sport rifles that they're proposing, even though it's violates state law, but regardless, if you don't support it, then you're
part of the problem.
You're not part of the problem. You're an accomplice to mass murderers. Oh. You're arming mass murderers. Mm-hmm. And these are the same people that support Lee Zeldin's attacker getting ROR'd, who support the defund the police, non-prosecution, decarceration prosecutors. Speaking of which, by the way, not that it's necessarily going to be a big improvement, but it's at least nice to see another Soros-funded non-prosecution, decarceration prosecutor getting rejected at the ballot box. Marilyn Mosby in Baltimore is going to be gone. Now, of course, it took her to be indicted by the federal government for
lying on her
perjury and mortgage fraud.
She's trying to buy three properties in Florida, of all places.
So Chesa Boudin, Marilyn Mosby, baby steps, because it's going to be baby steps in places that are as dysfunctional as Baltimore or San Francisco or Chicago.
But the fact that she didn't think she'd get caught, she could just lie on a mortgage application.
Whatever.
Well, it just shows her arrogance. Think rules for me, but not for thee.
All we ever hear from the left is about safety, 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 keeping people safe. And then the policies that they advance and the people they put in charge, or they put in policymaking positions, they do what? Are they keeping people safe?
No.
Jake in Kenosha, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. I think you touched on it a second ago when you said that the attempts to make anything better are never going to be realized unless the urban culture is addressed. The one thing that could universally be done across the board is anybody charged with a felonious crime with a firearm could be charged additionally in federal court with felon in possession of a firearm, but you're just targeting, you're just going disproportionately after persons of color, but that could be applied across the board. But no, it's not happening. Is there any mention that this guy's been arrested for felon in possession of a firearm again? No.
Yeah. Thanks for the call, Jake. I mean, I'm all for leveling up gun charges for federal prosecution, particularly when you can't get local prosecutors to be serious. And we've seen examples of that just recently with Operation Legend, Bill Barr during the Trump years. But it's just something more. I mean, this guy in Utah.
27-year-old dad.
It's child abuse doesn't begin to describe what he's done to those two kids.
Taking anger management and parenting classes, I actually think that's going to help.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Because if you watch the video further on, when they're actually, after the gun is out of the 4-year-old's hand and they're taking them out, the 4-year-old, he is bawling. He is crying so hard. And his sister, who's 3, is sucking her thumb as she's getting out of the car and she's shaking. I mean, it's just horrible.
So
they're going to stick with that. And then they turn and look at their dad who's on the ground being arrested.
So if you tell your 4-year-old to shoot a cop, then I think you're done being a father. I think that is a permanent loss of your custodial rights, for starters. And, you know, I mean, if you don't send that message, you know, all this talk we have that's sort of cultural in nature about the expectations we have for particularly dads, since they're so absent, the expectations we have for dads. Well, then there also has to be consequences when legal consequences are appropriate, as in this case, to send a message as well. If you participate in indoctrinating your kid to be a criminal, which is what this guy clearly was doing, then you're out. You're out. We'll find, not DCFS, but there's plenty of foster care operations that will...
Lydia Homes.
Lydia Homes is a good example. Help people find this kid or both kids and raise them in a loving environment. I mean, it has to be. You've got to make an example out of somebody like this guy. I mean, this is a staggering case, to me at least. And you can't just shrug your shoulders and say,
he's done his time, he's out, and I don't know where he is.
Yeah,
I don't know where that 4-year-old. I pray for that 4-year-old in Minnesota or in St. Paul.
Well, he should have child abuse, aggravated assault. He should have been charged with attempted murder. Yeah, that's what he should have been charged with. And
why are they going soft on him?
And he should be removed from society for a long time, if not forever. Not just for what he did that day, but what he's already done to his two kids.
There's not enough counseling in the world that could bring them back, I don't think.
Andy in Hinsdale.
This has nothing to do with guns, knives, cars, trucks, bombs, whatever your weapon. This has to do with a society that decided 50 years ago human life has no value, and you're free to kill a human based on the age. When we decided that abortion was legal, that was the slope of society where this kind of stuff will happen forever, whatever the weapon is. It doesn't have anything to do with the weapon.
Yeah, thanks for the call. The disposability of life, I think that's definitely a part of it. I mean, think about how selfish that act was. I'm willing to sacrifice my 4-year-old son. I can't even process the thinking. I'm willing to sacrifice my 4-year-old son. Say your 4-year-old son shot one of those cops. Well, how does that go? How does that go for him? How does it go for you? It's not like you're getting out of anything. The depravity the rot between the ears of somebody like this, it's indescribable, other than to provide what he actually provide the specifics of what he actually did. It's incomprehensible to me.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and as we're just a month away from kids going back to school, it's not just for San Diego anymore. We have school districts and communities looking to return to the last 2 years of mask mandates because of an increase in COVID-19 cases. In Ohio, indoor masking has been recommended in 8 greater Cincinnati counties as the CDC upgraded COVID-19 levels to high.
What color is that?
I think it's fuchsia. Yeah. And so once the communities go, the schools necessarily follow.
But in San Diego, they have a lot. It's a city of 1.4 million people. They have 11 people in the hospital with COVID. 11. That's it.
Yeah. Well, again,
if it saves one life,
we're going to see. I mean, we've seen what San Diego has done, and you're seeing what's being recommended for 8 Cincinnati area counties in Ohio. And so we're going to go back to probably some very colorful school board meetings if it goes that way in this state. And you know, in some locales, and particularly with the overlay of triple threat and Jelly Belly, carrying on about COVID and mask wearing and vaxes and boosters and so on and so forth, you know there's going to be some school districts that fold if the case level gets high and they have CDC cover to reimpose mask mandates and the like. And so that, of course, brings us to at least one example of what I'm talking about, and that's Joel Taub in Glenbrook School District 225. And the reason that we're bringing him up now is, one, a good example of a bad example, and two is there was an investigation into his conduct during a school board meeting in which he used profanity in the direction of a resident who refused to wear his mask when addressing the board in public comment. That investigation is now complete.
And the investigation cost $7,310. And what did they reveal? That Taub can stay on as a school board member.
Well, that the whole thing was silly. They conclude the board doesn't have the power to remove Taub. Yeah, right. Well, so if you knew that going in, then why even do the investigation? They do the investigation to say, oh, you know, we're very upset and he was admonished by the board and he apologized for his profanity. Just so you remember, this is how that went. Joel Taub, Glenbrook 225. You know, where all the smart people live, all the sophisticated, civilized.
Hate has no home here, people.
Deep thinking leftists in Northbrook and Glenview.
I'm embarrassed. It's humiliating for me. So, okay. Can I reset my clock?
Just start again. Go ahead, sir.
I'm resetting to 2 minutes.
We're going to let him speak without a mask.
Okay.
Well, he has a medical exemption.
Now he's interrupting me. I mean, you guys are rude.
How do we know?
Do I get to speak or not? Do I get to speak? Who's this? Are you the mask police? Can I speak or not?
We'll let you speak. Just one moment, please. Mr. Taub, did you have a question?
Is he in charge?
Okay. So
are you in charge?
No,
Mr. I'm speaking as public comment. You said at the beginning of the minute you would not be rude to people.
Enough.
Are you in charge?
Mr. Taub. Mr. Taub.
We should remove him. I mean, this is rude.
We'll start your 2 minutes now, sir.
This is not what you promised. You said if they don't wear a mask, they can't speak.
I have a mask. I can wear the mask on my head if you want. I mean, it's just...
You can wear your mask on your f***ing balls.
Okay, enough.
Kids were there.
Enough. We're going to take recess for 5 minutes. Please. We'll take a 5 minute
recess. Get out of the room if you can't put his f***ing mask on.
Mr. Taub, please. I'll call it back. Recess in 5 minutes. We'll take a recess.
Mr. Taub sounds like Gary McCarthy a little bit.
Is he up for re-election next year? I think so.
Yeah.
I think he's up for re-election next year.
And parents are already jonesing to, you know, there are a group of conservatives in Northbrook who are deciding who's going to run against him and take his spot.
I don't care who runs against him, but I can tell you that I'm going to run a campaign against him. And I don't care if he doesn't run again. I'm still going to run a campaign against him.
Well, he's a despicable human being.
This is exactly what we have to stand up against. And there are so many examples. We went through them all over the last 3 years. But just a couple more examples of the kind of people that we have allowed to have dominion over K through 12 education in this region. Algonquin.
Oh, boy.
Board President Scarpino.
I just want to remind folks, I understand you're performing for TV and everything. I get that. But please, 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 I will find you out of order, sir. Sir, that's it. Remove him. He's done. He's done. He's done.
They kept their kids hostage.
Our next speaker.
That's David Scarpino in Algonquin, the Algonquin High School District there. And he was commenting on the testimony during public comment from a mom of a special needs kid who was detailing how the mask negatively impacts her kid's ability to learn. And you heard the response. I know you're performing for TV, you know, the local access channel that these, or the YouTube channel that these board meetings are televised on. How ridiculous. But that's the sort of dismissive attitude. David Scarpino, he's on the hit list politically. We'll find out when everybody's up. Another one closer to home. Naperville High School District. They've got that goof of a superintendent, and they've got another perfect example. And by the way, you know, Algonquin, this is a more Republican area. Naperville used to be a Republican area. So it's a mixed bag here. It's COVIDians. Kristen Fitzgerald is the board president of the high school district.
Okay. We have some audience members with no masks on. Okay. Naperville 203 requires the indoor use of masks by all students, staff, and visitors, regardless of vaccination status. We require that all individuals in Naperville 203 buildings and facilities, including students, staff, teachers, and visitors, comply with the governor's indoor face covering or mask mandate. If you need a mask, one can be provided for you. I'm going to pause and we're going to take a brief recess while our audience comes into compliance.
And that's some of the lesser offensive comments. An example, some of the lesser egregious examples of the dismissiveness of Kristen Fitzgerald. Kristen Fitzgerald in Naperville 203, David Scarpino up in Algonquin, Joel Taub in Glenbrook 225. There's going to be a reckoning for them if I have anything to do about it politically at
Good.
The ballot box.
Do it.
And we'll continue to remind you who these people were as the spring elections roll around. Because you want to take your schools back. It starts next spring when you make an example of people who behaved as awfully as these people did and so many others. For more on this, pleased to be joined again by Jessica Hackett, a.k.a. Emma Woodhouse, who has...
She used to be on Twitter.
She just has to use Emma Woodhouse as her nom de plume, like in face-to-face meetings, because she's banned on social media. Jessica Hackett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. You're in Wheaton, and I know we recall having playing your testimony before the Wheaton-Warrenville School District Board. What's your sense of where this is going at present with what we see in San Diego, what we're hearing out of Ohio, and knowing what the disposition is of so many of these school boards and superintendents?
That's a great question. We'll see. I think Illinois is in a curious place because of Judge Grishow's decision last February, and most school districts did at least move toward or eventually have a mask optional policy. But you're right, as we've seen around the country, we're going to see this creeping in where people are going to, and school boards and superintendents are going to try to, as cases rise, they're going to try to put the mask mandates back in place. In Illinois, that is, by my reading of the Illinois school code and communicable diseases code, that is illegal for them just to set a blanket policy. But Judge Grischow, I believe, is set to rule on the underlying merits of the case sometime in August. So I really think that a lot of school districts and ISBE and IDPH are sort of just waiting, right, to see what happens with that. But August is coming, and we know something will happen. So there'll be some kind of series of announcements from schools, and then we'll see how parents react.
Well, CPS already announced that they are going to be quarantining people if you've been exposed and you're not vaccinated. And the push is on now, getting flyers, emails, get your kids vaccinated right now so that they can have a normal life at school come August 22nd. And not a lot of parents are biting. What is the percentage of kids or parents that have gotten their kids vaccinated that are 5 years old or younger?
I have not checked the stats lately. I don't think it's super, super high. I mean, 5+, you're also including teens. So it might be in the, 60% range or so. But what is the basis for saying, hey, Johnny, you were sitting next to, Mikey, who now has COVID. And so you have to stay home if you weren't vaccinated. I mean, there's no precedent for that. We don't do that for flu. We don't do that for RSV. But CPS parents have to fight back. Otherwise, CPS is going to just keep doing this kind of thing and intimidating parents into vaccination.
Yeah, you had this sort of remarkable admission by Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House spokesperson, yesterday, in comments about Biden testing positive for COVID, that, we're going to try contact tracing, but but contact tracing is, it's difficult. It's difficult to find out the source of where you got COVID. When I got COVID, we couldn't find out where I got the source of it. Well, that's really a staggering statement, because that's what a lot of people were saying when contact tracing was rolled out throughout the country and hundreds of billions of dollars were spent on this futile exercise.
Yep. In fact, Dan, Governor Pritzker, as I recall, one of the only things he said ever that I've agreed with is that you can't really ever know where somebody got COVID. And that's certainly true. Contact tracing. My sister worked in Ebola outbreaks in the Congo and other parts of Africa. And she's like, contact tracing? What is the United States doing that for? That is for localized outbreaks of certain kinds of diseases that are transmitted a certain way. The cat was long out of the bag in March 2020. And if the White House is saying, hey, no, we don't need to exposure quarantine anyone, I'm not sure why we have to exposure quarantine a kindergartner.
I know, because Jill Biden was a close contact. She shared a bed with him the night before. They had dinner together, and she's out at a school in Detroit. Saying, well, I'm masked up, but they didn't.
You're making some assumptions about their activities together. I know I'm being funny.
Right, but I'm saying if that was a child, they wouldn't be able to go to the school, but yet she can go in the school and interact with children. I mean, it's so selfish of her.
Right, yeah. It's absurd. But again, if parents don't know about or they don't exercise their due process rights under the law, it's going to be made okay because the CPS is saying it's okay. So critical that people fight back.
David Wallace Wells, who's a huge COVIDian writing the New York Times, talking about where we're at with COVID, that, it's gone endemic and hospitalizations bubble up and recede within a particularly narrow range. Same thing with deaths. But we have significantly more cases than we've had in the previous 2 years, year over year comparisons. And the endemic COVID, the upshot is it looks pretty brutal. We're going to have a lot of cases, even though we're not seeing hospitalizations and deaths jumping up in any significant fashion. It looks like it will be sort of a bad flu in terms of the more serious consequences of being infected with COVID. But it seems to me if you have, I know we're not counting cases anymore. They've moved off of that a little bit, and the cruise ships can do what they want, so they say. But it just seems to me, with so much ignorance that has spread over such a wide swath of Chicagoland, for that matter, as well as the rest of the nation, that the increased caseloads and any sort of spike in hospitalizations and death is going to bring the same calls from the same people to do the same things that we did over the last 3 years.
Right, and hope that they work. right? I mean, these things that we've done, the quarantines, the masking, the mass testing, they've led to less COVID exactly nowhere in the world. So, you know, speaking of testing, people should just, if they're sick, you know, stay home. If you're really sick, call your doctor and the doctor can decide, you know, hopefully within a clinical setting, what, if any, tests you need. So I've been hugely concerned the past couple of years about how these 15-minute, you know, COVID trailers and you guys have seen them. They've really come between the doctor-patient relationship, right? And let a test substitute for an actual diagnosis and just created more panic and lined people's pockets, not mine, but the investors in these testing companies.
So, Jessica, I have to ask, what did you do, young lady, to get kicked off Twitter again? And is this a permanent ban or what's going on? And are you fighting
back?
Well,
it's a permanent suspension, which I've had before. That was 2 days. This one, I think I'm going on 11 or 12. But the offending tweet was a post. I posted an article from the Wall Street Journal by the journal's Alicia Finley, where she was calling into question the process, approval process that was used for the toddler vaccine to give it an FDA EUA. And it was a direct quote. I just directly quoted. I used quotation marks. I didn't tag anyone. But the quote, what I said was the FDA, or what Alicia said, was the FDA conspicuously lowered its standards to approve COVID vaccines for toddlers. Why? And that was just the post. And then the next day, I was locked out of my account, permanently suspended for violating the COVID misinformation policy. They didn't say how, they didn't say which section of the policy. So it's a little bit like getting a parking ticket from, you know, Chicago and them saying, hey, you broke the parking laws, but won't tell you which one. I did appeal. I said, hey, this is a direct quote from the Wall Street Journal. What gives? Hello, reinstate me. But they said, we acknowledge your appeal. But they have not issued a decision. Right. So they really just need to follow their own policy all the way through, right? And if they want to just delete me, fine. But I just wish they would follow a process of some kind if they're going to have one.
Well, good luck with the Borg. Can we find your commentary anywhere else? Truth Social or Parler or Facebook?
Yeah, not any of those, but I am on Substack, so I post longer content there, which I actually really, really enjoy. I can still see my own Twitter account, so I really need to start moving more and more content, you know, from the past couple of years over to Substack. It is kind of a more permanent medium anyway, so I'm at woodhouse.substack.com.
All right, she is Emma Woodhouse. She's a Jane Austen fan. Her real name is Jessica Hackett. And woodhouse.substack.com is where you get her writings until and unless she is released from Twitter prison. Jessica Hackett, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Take care.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Of course, the big news yesterday, Joe Biden testing positive for COVID. I guess it's big news because of he's the president, obviously, but because
79.
Because of his age.
And he has cancer, right? Oh no.
He did for a second, then the White House remembered that he doesn't. And remembered that, in fact, he cured cancer.
Well, he has asthma, too.
Or is close.
I'm sorry. I mean, asthma's not good if you have COVID.
Biden releasing this video yesterday in response to the news that he tested positive.
Hey, folks, guess you heard. This morning I tested positive for COVID. But I've been double vaccinated, double boosted. Symptoms are mild, and I really appreciate your inquiries and your concerns. But I'm doing well, getting a lot of work done, going to continue to get it done. And in the meantime, thanks for your concern, and keep the faith. It's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. Oh, everybody, rest assured, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, we'll continue with our, you know, apocalyptic eco-politics and the like. Don't you fret. For more on Joe Biden as we inch closer toward the midterms and a bit of a a grading event for the Biden presidency, which doesn't look like it's going to receive high marks. Pleased to be joined by Gerard Baker again. He's the editor at large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So you wrote a piece in the Journal about Biden, something that I've been echoing since his candidacy, where everybody was talking about, does he have the capacity for the job? Is he too old? This and that. Joe Biden has essentially the same capacities and skill sets at 80 that he did at 30.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting. I mean, until a few months ago, or even up till now, actually, whenever the White House is, you know, supporters of Joe Biden are asked, you know, is he okay? Does he have the mental capacities? Is, you know, his cognitive abilities still okay? Can he do the job? They kind of say, well, you know, his mental capacities are just as they always have been. And that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, that's, you know,
yeah, exactly.
I mean, I don't want to be mean to the guy, and especially he's got COVID, and, you know, we wish him all the best. I should say, by the way, you know, 79, but my father is 102, and just got COVID and got over it in about a week. So the strains that are out there are generally pretty mild, and I'm sure the president will be fine. I certainly hope he is. Wish him well. But, you know, this is not a president. Look, they're trying to make the Democrats, who are now all expressing concern about his age. You know, we keep seeing these articles in the New York Times and elsewhere saying Democrats are, you know, now alarmed about his age. You know, I mean, well, first of all, they knew his age when they nominated him 2 years ago. They understood that he was, an elderly man. But secondly, again, as my point is, it's not his age. It's what he's done throughout his career, or rather what he's failed to do throughout his career. And I think how he's been behaving since he's become president. Look, yeah, he's lost a step or two, I'm sure a man of his age is bound to have done. But his behavior is basically in line with what he's done throughout his career. You know, it was Bob Gates, famously the defense secretary under President Obama, who said that Joe Biden had got every major foreign policy issue wrong in the last 40 years. And, you know, his political career is kind of a testament to that. I mean, there is nothing that we should really be surprised about. It's happened in the last 18 months that we should be ascribing to his age, because it's what he's been doing all his life. In particular, what he's been doing is essentially following the Democratic Party's lead, following wherever the center of gravity is in the Democratic Party, Joe Biden goes there.
But don't you think he's such a tryhard? I mean, yesterday he was trying hard to, you know, because of pollution and climate change, I have cancer. And I'm sure you heard him say that, because everybody heard that around the world. And the White House had to walk it back. But has he always been someone to over-exaggerate or even go so far as to lie?
Yeah, there's been a lot. You're absolutely right, Amy. I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, he got cancer from his mum wiping the windshield on the car. Yeah. That's a new one. I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, I'm sure that there's a lot of interesting, fantastic cancer research going on. I think there'll be some researchers wanting to look into that one. I mean, you know, by the way, he got skin cancer. And again, you know, he had skin cancers that were removed, but those are skin cancers caused by the sun, not by oil on the car, on the windshield of your car. You're right. I mean, he has this record of saying things that just aren't true. I mean, records of, you know, claiming that, you know, claiming he did extremely well in law school when, of course, he didn't. That goes back a long way. I think that was when he was running for president first time, you know, 140 years ago, whatever it was. He claimed he'd done very well in law school. It turned out he hadn't. He's claimed, you know, all kinds of experiences in his life. He's claimed to have done things. He claimed to be on, you know, civil rights marches when he wasn't. He claimed to be in, you know, having been, you know, the victim of various kind of assaults and this kind of stuff when he wasn't. Yeah, it is. And again, this is not simply the product of a man at 79 years old, you know, forgetting things or making things up or, you know, thinking he was in places when he wasn't, which does happen to men that age. As you say, he's been doing it throughout his career.
So how do you rate the prospects of Biden being taken out politically, not because of his age, but because of Hunter, with the news that, you know, it's reaching a critical, the investigation to Hunter's reaching a critical stage, whatever that means exactly. But the pronouncements that he's made since he was a candidate that he had nothing to do with Hunter Biden's business dealings overseas, and then the information on Hunter Biden's laptop that gives lie to those contentions, in addition to other evidence that gives lie to those contentions. Do you see, with a Republican Congress, right, the prospect of really putting Joe Biden through an impeachment proceeding potentially over his involvement with his son's foreign business dealings.
Yeah, I mean, I hope we don't sort of leap immediately to impeachment. I mean, this thing seems to be now the sort of standard procedure for every single president who gets elected, that the other side impeaches him as soon as they can, which is not really
right.
The way the process is supposed to work. But, right. I mean, look, I think there are real questions, Dan, and we're seeing, and again, you know, let me just pause to once again make an obvious point, but it is worth saying once again, the way the press allowed this to be essentially suppressed, in fact, the way the press suppressed this story back in the campaign and have essentially, you know, done their best to ignore it ever since, is really, is going to get raped in the, you know, it's one of the most shameful annals in the history of American journalism. But yeah, there are, we're learning more and more that Hunter Biden was clearly, and I remember, Dan, at the time, I can well remember when Joe Biden was vice president, I can remember talking to people and saying, people in the administration, I was, you know, in Washington at the time, saying, you know, Hunter Biden is a bit of a problem. He's going around the world basically trading on his father's name. And it just beggars belief that his father was ignorant of this, as he claims, that he didn't know what was going on. Because I'm pretty certain there were times when Joe Biden was specifically warned about this and specifically told, look, you know, there are concerns. It's very unlikely anyway. Let me put it this way. It's very unlikely, given what was known about what Hunter Biden was doing, that officials in the administration would not have said, look, you know, whether it's Ukraine or whether it's China or whether it's wherever else he was doing, you know, Latin America, all these other places where he was doing business, would not have said, look, you know, we need to be careful here, at least at minimum, to avoid the appearance of impropriety. You know, this needs to stop. And again, we've had it with other presidents when family members have tried to sort of, you know, cash in on their family connections. But Hunter Biden turned it into a kind of a, you know, did it on an industrial scale. And wow. The idea that he didn't know about it is just inconceivable.
Well, right. I mean, particularly when you have the examples of, you know, cutting the big guy in for 10% and Chinese energy deal and all of the other in Contra complaining about paying the big guy's bills and all these other things. I mean, clearly they were intertwined. Clearly there were conversations. What Hunter Biden said in that ABC interview was a lie. What Joe Biden said from the beginning of this being questioned about it when, you know, the rare occasion he is questioned about it, clearly just doesn't square with what we know to be true and what sort of logically follows from the information that we have. The question is, are there repercussions for it? And I understand we don't know that yet, but boy, it would seem to me, and I agree with you about, you know, jumping right to impeachment, but it would seem to me that this requires a real inquiry if we're going to suggest that leveraging your family's name and by extension public offices for personal gain, even to the point of compromising U.S. national security interests, which you could argue certainly with China, yeah, that's a real problem. That's a substantive issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, this is what you have is plausible allegations of essentially a form of corruption. Again, I stress we don't know that Biden himself was directly involved, but we have lots and lots of circumstantial evidence about what Hunter Biden was up to. And look, you know, some of the most interesting stuff I think we've seen in the last week or so is I think it was the New York Post or another paper reported these, you know, this remarkable series of coincidences where Hunter Biden would meet with some of these business people, as you say, from countries like China and elsewhere with national security implications, and then shortly afterwards would meet with his father, you know, either at the vice presidential residence in Washington or you know, in the White House or elsewhere or various places around town. You know, and again, it just defies belief to think that there was absolutely no awareness. There was no communication between Hunter and his father. And as you say, we've already heard about the 10% for the big guy. There's going to be, without any question, whether or not we get to impeachment, there's going to be plenty of material for Republicans who control Congress to really thoroughly investigate. And you have to say, I mean, one, it's right in itself. You should do, as you say, it's not what we expect from our leaders and for their family members to behave in this way. And secondly, you know, they've had this coming. I mean, they did pursue Donald Trump for 4 years over, particularly on the Russia stuff, which turned out to be almost entirely bogus. And they can't expect them, having done that for 4 years, having essentially, by the way, and I think it's fair to say, and I'm no fan of Donald Trump, as you know, but having really undermined his presidency and done all they could for the first 3 years of his presidency to make it almost impossible for him, as difficult as possible for him to get anything done by this process of investigation, you just cannot blame Republicans. You cannot expect Republicans to do anything less when there is so much smoke around this Hunter Biden stuff for them to go looking for fire, because that's, you know, that's after all the way politics now works these days. Why shouldn't they? And I think they will, and I think there's going to be plenty of material for them to work with.
A favorite story on Hunter Biden this week from the Babylon Bee, shocking photo of Hunter Biden seen wearing clothes, not smoking crack. Because that's about the we haven't seen.
Because everything we see
everything
is him,
he's naked. And he was with prostitutes and crack.
Yeah, yeah. It's disgusting.
Anyway, Gerard, I wanted to get your handle on what's going on with respect to replacing Bojo in the UK. I thought, despite the sort of trite hasta la vista sign off. It was sort of bizarre, but I thought it was interesting in a sign of, you know, let's cut taxes and deregulate to grow the English economy. You know, maybe if he would have been doing that as PM, he'd still be PM.
Yeah, look, you hit on a very good point there, Dan. I follow it. I'm over this side of the Atlantic now rather than there, but I do follow things closely over there. I have a lot of friends involved in politics and covering it. And I think you hit on exactly the point there. Look, Boris got into a lot of hot water over the so-called party gate, you know, this endless series of parties that were going on during lockdown. He kind of was very, 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 very squiffy, very strange with the truth, squirrely about it. And that got his reputation for dishonesty. And it was his reputation for dishonesty that did him so much damage. But with a lot of conservatives, that you hit on the right point. That is exactly what they're concerned about. Conservatives were elected coming up for three years ago with the largest majority they've had since Margaret Thatcher was prime minister more than 30 years ago. They had an extraordinary opportunity to really, and by the way, they did it in this with this remarkable new electoral coalition with a lot of former Labour seats in Labour constituencies in the north of England and the Midlands voting Conservative. They had this extraordinary opportunity, this vast majority, not only to get Brexit done, which they did, which he said they would do, but to actually reshape Britain and, you know, to really lay the foundations for Britain's future after it left the European Union. And that could be, and that's what a lot of conservatives wanted after all, was, you know, cutting taxes, cutting the size of the state, making Britain a much more dynamic place. In fact, what they've spent the last 2.5, nearly 3 years doing is raising. Now, we have the pandemic. Admittedly, that's, you know, they were knocked off course by the pandemic. But they could still, you know, they've been largely out of the pandemic in the UK for a year. Bob Johnson has shown no sense of direction, certainly not a sense of direction that most conservatives would agree with. So we're going to have got a leadership election now. We're down to the final two. The members in the country vote. I have to say, there's not a lot of excitement, not a lot of enthusiasm about the two main candidates. Rishi Sunak, who is the Chancellor, was the Chancellor of the Exchequer, is kind of campaigning for more of the same of the Conservatives of the last 2.5 years. That is kind of pretty centrist, fairly, you know, policies that are almost indistinguishable from what the Labour opposition would do. There is Liz Truss, who is the other candidate. She is campaigning hard for a change of direction and for a more conservative approach. But there's a problem there, is that she's been a member of the government for the last 3 years. So it's not, and neither of them really inspiring much excitement and much confidence. It's a pretty bleak set of circumstances for those who want to see a more conservative leaning, more dynamic, more economically growth oriented Britain.
And how long is this going to take? I mean, is it going to go until the winter time, or how long will he be
minister? It's members of the Conservative Party. They send out the ballot papers next week, and they have to return them. It's mostly electronic, actually, but they most have to return them by a few weeks later, and we'll have the result on September the 5th, okay. And there'll be a new prime minister on September the 5th.
He is Gerard Baker, editor-at-large, Wall Street Journal. Gerard, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Don't miss Cigar Night with Dennis Prager, Dan Proft, and Sean Thompson on Thursday, August 18th. Get your tickets today at 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We talked to a lot of academics and industry analysts about things like international trade. But it's always good to talk to a practitioner. So pleased to be joined by Charlie Pagley, who's the CEO of American Bantam, which is a company that is in the business of,
off-road vehicles.
I'll be specific here, is a heritage mobility brand bringing cutting-edge plug-in hybrid electric powertrain technology to propel the off-road industry into the 21st century, talking about side-by-sides and UTVs specifically. And Charlie Pagley has experience in doing business in China, speaks Mandarin, as I understand from his bio. So I thought manufacturing, if an American manufacturing with experience in China, a lot of issues to talk about, including but not limited to the automotive space. By the way, American Bantam Corp, they're credited with building, designing and building the prototype for the vehicle for the U.S. Army that would become one of America's most iconic vehicles. That's vehicle types. That's the U.S. Army Jeep. So long history here. Charlie Pagley, CEO of American Bantam, joins us now. Charlie, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
Morning. So,
and I should say that actually American Bantam was the first manufacturer, the first mass producer of Jeeps, and they were the exclusive manufacturer of Jeeps for the U.S. Army in 1940.
Oh, okay, okay.
The other Ford and Willys didn't start building Jeeps until a year later.
Interesting. Okay.
But that's not what we're doing now. We're actually trying to go back to the roots of the Jeep and build a lightweight vehicle that is street legal, that you can, but that has the performance, like you were mentioning, like a side-by-side, a UTV.
Mm-hmm. And for those not familiar with the side, I mean, I see I see them all the time at like gun clubs, you know, guys drive around the sporting clays course and these things, but just give us a little bit of color on that type of vehicle and its varied uses.
Well, you know, in rural Illinois, you'll see them all over the place. Technically, according to federal regulations, they shouldn't be driving on the roads, but they're kind of like in a gray area. So people drive them on the roads a lot of places, but you can't drive them on a federal highway. You certainly can't drive one into Chicago. And they have really bad emissions. They emit one side-by-side has the emissions of about 11 cars. So the big names out there are Polaris and BRP, which is Can-Am. What we looked at that market and we said, you know what? We can build something that's street legal that has the same performance. And so we have to meet the same emissions that a normal automobile has to meet, but we're going to have the same performance that your average UTV will have.
It's perfect for driving around senior communities too, like the villages in Orlando.
Yeah, kind of like a souped up golf cart. But what's the difference between an ATV and a UTV?
Huh. Well, depends on who you ask.
Well, I'm asking you.
The federal government's concerned. The federal government says a UTV is an ATV, but if you go into a Polaris store, a UTV, you kind of sit on it like a horse, and a UTV is a side-by-side. You have two people sitting next to each other. An ATV, you sit on it like a motorcycle. So you have one person in front of the other.
So talk to us about the automotive industry and manufacturing in America at present, vis-a-vis your experience in China as a manufacturing executive as well.
Well, so I came to China a long time ago, and I've seen a lot of manufacturing from the United States come over to China. And a lot of people will say, oh, you know, it's too expensive to manufacture things in the United States, or the supply chain in the United States is kind of broken. For instance, here in China, I've got 50 different manufacturers I can go get bolts from. But in the United States, you don't have 50 different manufacturers. And a lot of the manufacturers that you buy bolts from, they're going to be bringing their stuff over from China or India or somewhere else. So in that respect, yeah, some of the supply chain is broken. But 20, 30 years ago, executives in the United States made a decision that they were going to take manufacturing and move it overseas. And when they were doing this, it was very painful. But they had to do it, and they got it done. Now, American Bantam has made the decision, we're going to take manufacturing from China, and we're going to move it back to the United States. So we're right now in negotiations to buy a factory in the United States. And hopefully in 2024, we will start producing our vehicles in the U.S.
And what was the basis for that decision to move to onshore, as they say?
You know, it was just living over in China, watching what was happening in the United States, watching factories get shut down, watching people not have jobs, and saying, you know, somebody should do something about this. And then the question was, well, why don't I do something about this, or what if our company does something about this? And so that's how we got started.
Well, I'm sure you've heard about Ford. They're reportedly planning to cut 8,000 jobs over the next coming weeks in an effort to fund its plans to build EVs.
Yeah. Yes.
So we're trading in one thing, for, you know, livelihoods for the climate. Doesn't it seem like that?
Well, I think that that's a very short-sighted attitude. I think that there's definitely a place for electric vehicles. I built my first electric vehicle in 1991. I built two in 1991 and a third in 1992. So I was a chief executive for Fisker Automotive, the first Fisker in China, 10 years ago. More like 12 years ago. So I'm definitely on board with electric vehicles. But the idea that you're going to completely replace gasoline vehicles with electric vehicles, as a professional in the industry, I think that a lot of my counterparts in the industry are making a huge mistake. They're doing something just for the press, and they're not asking their customers what their customers want. You know, if you try to the Ford F-150 Lightning, the new Lightning, it's a great vehicle, but if you try to tow a trailer with it, I think Magna just did a test, towing a trailer behind a gasoline vehicle and behind an electric vehicle. The electric one got 85 miles.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Try go camping 85 right. miles away from Chicago. It's not going to be a really exciting thing.
It doesn't even get you to Starved Rock. That's really interesting. But going back to sort of the larger climate then, you know, we heard stories toward the end of the Trump administration that the change in focus was really happening, and that you had a lot more American companies because of, as you were sort of intimating, what's happening in China, looking to at least move from China to some other Far East country like Vietnam, as opposed to have any footprint in China. And I wonder if in the automotive industry or generally you see that continuing to happen, where people are either thinking about onshoring, and maybe for some of the reasons that American Bantam decided to do that, like you were describing, or they're at least exiting China for countries that are more friendly to the United States.
Well, for American Bantam, the name has American in it. And I just think it would be sacrilegious to manufacture vehicles in China and export them to the United States. So we're still going to build vehicles in China for the China market and for the Southeast Asia market. But we'll build vehicles in the United States. And so that onshoring process is part of the manufacturing in China process. Now, I do see manufacturers here in China, especially different vertical segments like tires and what go along with tires, like wheels. Yeah, those are going south, going to Thailand, going to Vietnam, going to Sri Lanka, before Sri Lanka kind of got into a little trouble.
Yeah.
But the thing that really makes China an incredibly competitive place to do automobiles is the supply chain here. I mean, there's 200 different automobile companies in China, compared with what, 3, 4, 5 in the United States. Really, I mean, you probably have three manufacturers that are American-owned, Ford, GM, and Tesla. And then you have like Lucid and Aptera, and Fisker is trying to give it a second go. But those guys aren't really manufacturing. I would say you have to manufacture over 5,000 vehicles a year to be a real car company. So that's kind of the watermark, that once you get there, then, you should be self-sustaining.
So what's your experience as a manufacturer in China vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist government? I mean, the handle is that there's really no such thing as a privately held company in China because you're either informally or formally taking your marching orders from the CCP.
No, that's some good rhetoric, some good propaganda. But I was making some metal stamping plates just today, and we probably dealt with five different suppliers that helped to make these parts. You know, one does the tooling, one does the stamping, one does the actual sheet metal, one does the bolts that were welded on it. Another supplier welded the thing onto the bolts, and one manufacturer did the chroming on it, the surface rust protection on it. So none of those guys are controlled by communists. These are all mom and pop companies. Literally, the guy making the tools, he's one guy. He's got two employees. The guy making the bolts, well, I don't know. I have no idea where that guy is. The guy doing the rusting, the welding, one guy. So it's really important to differentiate between, say, a company like Huawei. Huawei is definitely a company that has communist government backing. But a lot of the little mom and pop companies here, it's more like the United States was back in the 1950s, when instead of having, or even go back further, 1920s. In the 1920s, there were 200 plus U.S. automobile manufacturers. That's what China is like today.
And so, it's interesting. And that sort of, that dissection of the caricature is important. So then as a manufacturer, the charge is for the political class here is to bring more companies back to America or to keep companies here as opposed to offshoring their production. So you've made the decision, American Bantam has made the decision to do that in part, as you say. And what would you say about the relationship from your perspective as a manufacturer between China and the United States? What should policymakers be thinking about vis-a-vis China that would create a more favorable environment for manufacturers to keep or to relocate production facilities here?
You know, it's very interesting that you asked that question, because in 2016, I wrote a letter to the Trump administration, or to the incoming Trump administration, incoming Trump administration, and I suggested that the United States should just do exactly what China does. So if China puts a 16% VAT onto all foreign products going into China, then the U.S. should do the same. And if China charges 50% on all automobiles going into China, then the United States should do the same. And indeed, such a bill was put before Congress back in 2016, and Congress rejected it. So, and the reason why, well, I don't know. All of these things are above my pay grade, but I believe the reason why they rejected it was because a lot of people have special interests there. So there's you don't want, if somebody's has a business based on not being able to, on not having to pay those kind of import duties, they don't want that to continue.
So the tit for tat when it comes to Chinese trade policy is what you think is in America's best interest.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He is Charlie Pagley, CEO and founder of American Bantam. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Bill Burr is at it again, stand-up comedian. In a His latest stand-up special that was shot at Red Rocks in Colorado, which is a cool-looking venue, by the way.
Oh, doesn't it look great?
Burr tackled abortion. You're familiar with Burr. We've played some of his bits before, like on white privilege, particularly, the Chardonnay Antifa in places like Hinsdale, these pea hat-wearing rich white women.
No, it's unreal. I'm really fucking annoyed how white women have the fucking balls to throw my white privilege in my face, you know? Sort to separate themselves from these white males with their white male privilege. It's like, bitch, you're sitting in a jacuzzi with me.
I love that. I love that. Well, here's Bill Burr riffing on abortion per the Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Yeah, it's trying to stay topical.
Because I don't like people telling me what to do. And I always just like, it's your body. Who the f*** am I to tell you what to do with your body? So that always made sense. All right? However, I still think you're killing a baby. See? That's where it gets weird. Like, I sit on the fence and the whole thing makes sense to me. Whatever anybody's saying, like, don't tell you what to do. It's my body, my choice. That's right, man. She's right. Leave me the hell alone. Why are you killing a baby? Well, I mean, there is that. You know? I mean, you know, if we're going to be honest, that is the whole purpose of the procedure. You know, you're not going in there because you got an earache. You're going in there because you're like, I got a baby in me. Get the fuck out of here. Right? You walk in with a baby. You come out without one. What happened to the baby, right? Something f***ing happened. So pro-choice people are like, well, it's not a life yet. It's not a baby yet. If you do, I don't know what they say. Well, you do the first Thursday or the last Tuesday, you sit around all the time, they dance between the raindrops. It's not a baby yet. That's what they say, which may or may not be true. I don't know. I'm not a doctor. But I'll tell you, my gut tells me that doesn't make sense. It's not a baby yet. That would be like if I was making a cake and I poured some batter in a pan and I poured it in the oven and then 5 minutes later you came by and you grabbed the pan, you threw it across the floor. And I went, what the f***? You just ruined my birthday cake. And then you were like, well, that wasn't a cake yet. It's like, well, it would have been. If you didn't do what you just did, there would have been a cake in 50 minutes. Something happened to that cake, you cake murdering son of a bitch.
Yeah, well,
wow.
His instincts are right, even though, as he admits, he's not a doctor. Two doctors, Christina Francis and Catherine Glenn Foster, writing in Newsweek, both are, Dr. Christina Francis, she's a board member, CEO-elect of the American Association of Pro-Life OBGYNs, and Catherine Glenn Foster is a lawyer, president, CEO of American United for Life. The main problem for the pro-abortion narrative is that abortion is, in fact, not necessary to treat pregnancy complications. According to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, an induced abortion is a procedure intended to terminate a pregnancy so that it does not result in a live birth. In other words, the specific purpose of an induced abortion is to end the life of a preborn child. From a medical standpoint, that is never necessary. The fact is clear in the case of miscarriage management, which in no way involves ending a life, only the removal of an embryo or fetus who's already deceased. Other difficult pregnancy conditions may require doctors to separate a mother from her preborn child to save her life, but that is not the same as an abortion. For example, even Planned Parenthood acknowledges that managing an ectopic pregnancy, in which the embryo implants outside of the uterus, is not an abortion. Not. That's an important point because Planned Parenthood removed or changed the wording that they had with respect to ectopic pregnancies. Medical procedures for abortions are not the same as the medical procedures for an ectopic pregnancy. That's Planned Parenthood. That's important because one of the talking points coming from the pro-abort left since the Dobbs decision is in an ectopic pregnancy, she wouldn't be able to get an abort, so on and so forth.
Right, and she could die.
Right, hemorrhage and die. Right.
Which well, she could. But
that's a lie. But it's not. That's not an abortion.
Right.
And the treatment is not tantamount to abortion. So that and we've talked to Dr. Leventino talked about, you know, how he's had to end pregnancies by delivering the baby. Never once in thousands since he stopped being an abortionist and became a pro-life OBGYN, never once has he had to have an abortion to ever had to perform an abortion to save the life of a mother. The way you deal with a complication is to bring the child, you know, to deliver the child, yeah. Right? So anyway, so, you know, you've got the sort of street version of gut instincts from Bill Burr, and then you also have the medical opinions of people who know, their practitioners. For more on all this, we're pleased to be joined by Peter Breen, Vice President and Senior Counsel, Thomas More Society. Peter, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, glad to be with you guys.
Where do you think things stand here as you've got, forgetting even the violence for a second, which we'll get to, but, you know, you've got all of these hysterics, the histrionics from the pro-abortion left, including from Pritzker here in Illinois. What do you think? You think that anybody's opinions are being moved? Do you see this debate really changing in any material way from what it was prior to the Dobbs decision?
Well, you know, quick reaction. There was a, you know, the national media went after the pro-life side hard. You know, the abortion side was very, very adept with their manipulation of the national media at the beginning. But we're starting to see the numbers return back to just where folks had been. I will tell you, you know, the clips like Bill Burr, you know, he's right, obviously, that, yes, that is a baby. You know, this is what abortion does. You know, it's the reason that abortion was illegal for most of our nation's history leading up to 1973 with the Roe decision. And you know, for the other side, the more they actually talk about abortion, I mean, the longer that the Bill Burr clip goes on, the more the audience actually has to think about the baby. It's positive for pro-life. I mean, you watch the other side. They have to get the topic away from abortion relatively quickly over to something else that's not an abortion to try to get you to stop thinking about it. Because it's the sort of thing, as a human, you're sitting there going, why would I want to, you know, terminate the life of baby humans? And like, that's just, you know, it's against our biology. It's against everything we've been taught and everything that we know instinctually.
Right, you have to remove the humanity in order to justify the action, and that's sort of what Bill Burr was saying. But I mean, come on, who are you kidding? We know what the deal is. You know, we know where this is going when you're pregnant if you don't have an abortionist intercede. So let's just be honest about it, then have conversations like Kansas is having through a referendum that comes to election on August 2nd. About the legislature's power to regulate abortion in Kansas. There's no inherent right in the Constitution. That's what Kansas voters will decide. As well as the discussions in states like Illinois about returning the parental notification law into being so that parents are at least notified. So that's the other piece of it. You have to remove the child's humanity and make it something that it isn't. And then secondly, you also have to take the extreme cases and focus on them exclusively. So you have, for example, Jelly Belly here running around talking about rape and incest and extremism. And you have a state that is abortion on demand all 9 months, taxpayer funded, no parental notification, and he wants to make the conversation about rape and incest exceptions rather than, you know, what is really possible is important, which is things like parental notification, late-term abortion prohibitions, and the like.
Well, and you're seeing the mainstream media, you know, is not going to challenge Pritzker. You know, come back to him and go, okay, the rape and incest related abortions are less than 1%, always have been. So the 99%, you're not talking about. Why won't you talk about that, Governor? That's what an honest, you know, interviewer would ask him, going like, why are you even talking about the outside cases when we're so bad on everything else? But the people have got to now start asking these questions. And the more we think about this issue and what actually occurs there, it does help to make the populace more pro-life. Certainly in the blue states like Illinois, most folks are in a more kind of a moderate, call it pro-choice position. You know, maybe they want to, you know, they're fine with an abortion prohibition after 15 weeks or 12 weeks, or some folks in heartbeat. And so we're just not even exploring that right now, though, in the blue states because of the extremism coming out. I'll tell you, the place we're focusing at Thomas More is in the red states. We've started to now work on the legislative side, not our our usual thing at Thomas More is, you know, we're in court lawyers, but there is so much need for help. Indiana's Exhibit A. You've got a bunch of legislators down there that have been filling out pro-life surveys saying, oh yeah, I'm fully pro-life, blah, blah, blah. Pro-lifers have been supporting them for decades. And all of a sudden now it's time for them to actually deliver. And you're seeing some real problems. You know, they dropped a very bad bill. Yeah. And so this is where we're looking right now as, you know, for our red state strategy, all the states surrounding Illinois getting good pro-life legislation in place, and then hopefully even legislation that could prevent folks from being taken to Illinois for abortions. And then in Illinois, you've got to just continue to do this work redoubled. You know, if we're going to add 20 or 30,000 abortions potentially to Illinois, you've got a lot more work on the sidewalk. You've got a lot more work of advocacy. You need more pregnancy centers. And so those are kind of our blue state and red state sorts of strategies.
So you want to stop women from other states from coming to Illinois to have an abortion?
You know, and Amy, here's the funny thing. People are saying, well, you can't stop the right to travel. And I'm like, of course you can't stop the right to travel. The problem is abortion involves two human beings. And the Dobbs decision, that was a critical point of it. So the Dobbs decision said, hey, we're not touching gay marriage or anything else because abortion's unique because it involves two human beings. So if you say to yourself, hey, you know, can I stop someone from going across state lines for a medical procedure? Well, of course not. However, can I stop someone from taking a child across state lines for abuse and killing? Well, then you have a very different answer. And you say, of course, a state has an interest there. And the problem we've got is in the state of Illinois, that child doesn't even rise to the level, the dignity of property. That child is medical waste in the womb. However, in the state of Iowa, for instance, the child may be considered a full human person. And so the state of Iowa is going to say, hey, you can't take unborn Iowans over to Illinois to be killed, or Missouri would say the same thing. And so we are going to have some tension in the law, but the state's protective interest over its children, and then, in fact, state's protective interest for its born residents, when 60% of abortions are folks who've had abortions will say, I felt coerced or forced. I mean, really, over half of the abortions in this country, folks will say, I felt coerced or forced. You know, states have a strong interest in protecting their residents, both born and unborn. So that's really, but that will cause a lot of tension in the law in these next coming years.
Yeah, absolutely. And the coercion piece is an important one. And it's not folks, it's women, of course, as we know. But something else, though, too, the Republican piece of this. I know you said it, I've said it, a lot of other people said, too, that the importance of this decision, it's going to flush out those Republicans who were taking the pro-life position because it was politically advantageous and never thought there would have to be consequences attached to it. And we're going to see who's real and who isn't, which is a great service. I mean, this is not their intent, of course, but it's a great service the Supreme Court did as well politically within the pro-life party's ranks to separate the honest brokers from the phony balonies.
And Dan, I remember when I was in the legislature, I was sitting with Governor Bruce Rauner, you know, his governor at the time, and you know, who had also been a big donor to Republicans. So you're sitting there going, he's got the same mindset of some of these big donors. And I remember him saying, we were sitting across the table, he said, well, Roe v. Wade's never going to be overturned. And right. You know, everybody else around the table, you know, dutifully went, oh, yes, yes, Governor, yes. And I'm going, yeah, I don't think so. You know, that's, you know, we're going to get it done. And it's just that was their mentality. Oh, well, you know, Roe will never be overturned, so your abortion position doesn't really matter that much in the Republican Party. And now, you know, that's, you know, the folks are being called to the carpet for what they, you know, put their signatures on. You know, the surveys they filled out and the pro-lifers that went and walked precincts for them are now going, hey, what, you know, you said you were pro-life and now, you know, what is this trash that you're putting up on the board?
Exactly. It's great. I love it. You know, nothing like accountability. You know, since you mentioned you were in the General Assembly, you're a state legislator. So when it comes to this state and talking about it, what advice and counsel, I'm sure you've been giving it, what advice and counsel would you give to Republican candidates on the ballot in November from Darren Bailey on down? How should they discuss it?
Well, the thing to do is to focus, as you had said earlier, parental notice. I mean, you want to talk about an issue that's a 70-80% approval issue. Talk about parental notice. That fits into our parental rights narrative. It fits in as well just to this whole thing of government getting over, you know, just too far into our lives and being too, you know, and the Illinois government particularly being way out of step with the rest of the country. And so that's the sort of thing I would talk about. I'd really focus there at those 60 and 70% approval issues. And that's such an easy one. And no matter where you are, parental notice polls well, it works well. And then, you know, look, don't be afraid to defend your pro-life physician, because when you look at the polling, roughly 80% of the American public says, actually Illinois, these are Illinois numbers, 80% say that the abortion position of their politicians is important to them. Now, that may not be their top voting issue. They may vote on gas prices or whatever else. But if 80% say it's important, they don't mind you talking about it. I know it's not pleasant. It's not the sort of thing you enjoy talking about. But you need to be able to talk about it when so many people find it important to their voting decision.
You're participating in a Law of Life Summit that's coming up next week. Tell us about that.
Well, I'll tell you. So since Dobbs, folks who are interested in pro-life are wondering, hey, what is next? You know, what are we doing in blue states, red states? The landscape has totally changed. And so really cool. The organizers of the Law of Life Summit, which normally would be in D.C., they're coming to Schaumburg. So it's going to be Schaumburg Renaissance Marriott Wednesday, Thursday of next week, the 27th and 28th. You've got the head of Sidewalk Advocates for Life, Lauren Zika, David B. Wright, the founder of 40 Days for Life. You've got Father Frank Pavone, head of Priests for Life, is coming. A lot of folks, Michael New, who's our kind of law professor, you know, the professor of the pro-life movement. So huge event. And really, all of the, you know, you've got lots of national pro-life leaders there to not just give you speeches, but to actually talk shop. So we're doing panel discussions that are going to be back and forths, really exploring some of these new frontiers and what does the future look like now. You know, it's been put this way, we're really on the 50-yard line for those in the pro-life movement. It took 50 years to get here. I hope it doesn't take another 50 to get to the place where we want to be, which is where abortion is unthinkable, is really the idea. But you know, we're now the field's open, it's time to work. And so you'd get the best minds from across the country, you know, activists, lawyers, everybody. So really, and just a great group of people. So if you're looking to get out of the house and, you know, you're tired of COVID and everything else, you know, you're going to have a wonderful group of people that you're going to be able to interface with and you know, share with, you know, all of that.
Are you concerned about safety at all?
You know, hotels have been pretty good about that. I'll tell you that, you know, I'm sure there'll be counter protesters, but we've been blessed so far that most of the time, the Antifa people and all of that, what they do is they do after dark, no one's home, you know, vandalism. You know, they vandalized probably, where I think we're up to 30 pregnancy centers, 30 of these, you know, ministries to help pregnant women have been vandalized, firebombed. You've got at least 20 churches that were more pro-life, so they've been vandalized. But it's all been not direct physical individual to individual things. So, you know, I have to tell you, to some extent, too, you know, it's good that you're getting counter-protested. It to some extent means you're over the target. You know, it's really, you know, so that's, you know, you almost hope for, you know, a good group of counter-protesters. But again, the safety side, we're not really worried about that.
The Law of Life Summit next week, Wednesday, Thursday, the 27th and 28th at the Schaumburg Renaissance Marriott to register lawlife.org. Lawlife.org is how you register to attend. Peter Breen's the VP and senior counsel at the Thomas More Society. Peter, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Open mic. Open mic Friday. Call in now.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Yes, it's that time of the week. Open Mic Friday, taking your calls with comments, compliments, criticisms, general correct pottery. We'll take it all. 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA. Turnkey.pro text line. Amy, do you have something you'd like to offer? Because I have something.
You know what? Ladies first.
Oh, I see what you did there. This is a story we talked about a while back, and it's being reintroduced appropriately, and including by the Republican nominee for Attorney General, Tom DeVore. This is the curious case of Jenny Thornley, the former CFO and Director of Legislative Policy for the Illinois State Police Merit Board.
And she's also very good friends with M.K. Pritzker.
and JB and Sherry Bustos and Tammy Duckworth and Susana Mendoza, according to her.
Yeah, they're all besties.
So this is a real profile in corruption under Jelly Belly, which doesn't get nearly the airing it deserves. We mentioned one of the other issues earlier this week, and this is an issue that's been brought up by some state's attorneys, too, including Glasgow and Will County. The idea of paying staff members of the governor's office, a state agency, out of your personal resources. Pritzker did it, is doing it. Rahner did it. So then the question is, are you a state employee or are you a personal employee of the governor to do his bidding on a personal level rather than, yes, you're going to do the bidding within the confines of the law for the governor, but you're still a state employee being paid by taxpayers and you have responsibility to them. And it confuses that issue. That's a problem. This is a bigger problem. In January of 2020, Thornley's boss, Jack Garcia, wrote the merit board. Remember, this is the Illinois State Police Merit Board. Corruption at the Illinois State Police Merit Board. The ironies abound in Illinois. Jack Garcia, Thornley's boss, wrote to the merit board's chairman that he had caught Thornley forging his signature to pad her salary with overtime. That would be a crime.
Right.
Then program administrator Emily Fox, who is now the merit board's executive director and who has filed a whistleblower lawsuit or did file a whistleblower lawsuit that was dismissed. We'll get to that. Said, for example, that Thornley had billed 32.5 hours of overtime in September of 19, even though camera footage showed that not only did she not work overtime, but she frequently left during regular hours. That's called fraud.
Uh-huh. Oh, and it gets worse.
Yeah. So there's one thing. On January 27th of 2020, so the end of the month, after Jack Garcia wrote the merit board about catching Thornley, forging his signature to pad her salary with overtime, the end of the month in 2020, Thornley texted a mutual friend of hers and Jack Garcia's and told him, this mutual friend, Garcia doesn't know who he's messing with and that the governor's office would get involved if Mr. Garcia did not back off. 4 days later.
What happened to Mr. Garcia?
Well, four days later, Jennifer Thornley filed a workers' comp claim. She had suffered bruising and PTSD from being sexually assaulted by Garcia the day after he reported her alleged fraud.
And apparently she claims that, his arm brushed up against her breast while she was, there was no grabbing, there was no touching. And it's even worse because he wasn't even there that day.
Well, we have an investigation, too, that was done, an independent investigation that was done by McGuire Woods. On February 3rd, just to give you the timeline here, let's, go chronologically. The merit board moved to fire Thornley and seek criminal prosecution. Around that time, Thornley told the governor's deputy general counsel, Scott Lerner, that, quote, I just really want to make sure this doesn't look bad for Governor Pritzker and MK. According to court filings, again, the governor's office advised the board to hold off on firing Thornley and instead put both her and Garcia on leave. The governor's office also advised the merit board to hire McGuire Woods law firm to do an independent investigation. McGuire Woods conducted a thorough investigation costing $550,000. As that investigation was pursued, Thornley was paid, and the merit board had no leader, even though Jack Garcia had passed a lie detector test corroborating that he did not sexually assault her. In point of fact, the merit board chairman, Reeve Wadd, wrote to the governor's office in April that, quote, the board is unanimously of the view that this has gone on long enough that your intervention, meaning the governor's, was and remains unwise and inappropriate. If the governor feels differently, I would welcome the opportunity to discuss the entire situation with him. In July, McGuire Woods produced a 133-page report concluding that the evidence showed that Thornley stole from taxpayers and that it did not support the evidence, did not support that Garcia sexually assaulted her. It also said Thornley falsely claimed to have COVID to avoid being interviewed by the investigators.
Oh, of course. I mean, what a piece of what.
She was fired, finally.
Well, where does Garcia go to get his reputation and his job back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the problem, because I've heard wonderful things about him.
Garcia attempted to get the inspector general to investigate the workers' comp claim involving Thornley allegedly claiming she worked for the governor and the governor's office mysterious cooperation, but it did not seem interested, again, according to the suit. No IG investigation into, you know, these multiple embezzlement schemes she had going on. That led to this whistleblower suit that I mentioned at the outset by the current executive director of the Illinois State Police Merit Board, this woman named Fox. In the lawsuit, the success of Thornley's most recent false statements is a consequence of the direct involvement of the governor's office. There's no reason the governor's office should be involved in Thornley's schemes except for Thornley's personal and political relationships with the governor and or M.K. Pritzker. Thornley was subsequently indicted on 7 felony counts related to the alleged timekeeping fraud in September of 21, and her workers' comp benefits were terminated a few days before the indictment.
That's nice. Does she have to pay that back?
She has not been charged for filing a work comp claim over sexual assault the government concluded did not occur or falsely stating that she worked for a different office. In December of 2021, so at the end of last year, Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul moved to have the whistleblower complaint thrown out. His discretion, the Attorney General's discretion to do so. The case was dismissed. That was his argument. The case was dismissed. Fox, the woman who filed the whistleblower suit, intends to appeal. It should also be noted 4 of the 5 merit board, Illinois State Police Merit Board members, including the chairman, Reeve Wadd, who push back against the governor's office, your involvement is unnecessary and inappropriate, have since been replaced.
Of course.
The legislature inserted a provision into a spending bill that had the effect of forcing Garcia out of his position. Tom DeVore, who's the Republican nominee for governor attorney general against Kwame Raoul, said, "This is exactly why our state is corrupt. These kinds of issues on a grand scale are exactly why people don't trust the government." Yeah, I'd say so.
And think about it. They spent $550,000 in taxpayer funds to not investigate Jenny Thornley once, but to investigate her twice.
Yeah, I mean,
she's a bad egg, and it says a lot about the Pritzkers that they have her as a friend.
Well, it's also the rules. If you're a friend of the governor, then the governor tries to make your criminal conduct disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me again about the page that has been turned and the new day in Illinois state government under Jelly Belly, who's gotten a complete pass on this story from the Chicago and Springfield Press Corps, which is a disgrace.
I tried to ask them about it once and they ran off.
And to your point, too, Jack Garcia playing the role of Ray Donovan, former labor secretary for Reagan. You know, where does he go to get his reputation back after this whole saga, which he was completely exonerated? Jennifer Thornley, she didn't walk from this, thankfully, because of the evidence that was called together and because of some oversight by the board itself, the Illinois State Police Merit Board. But I mean, the Illinois State Police Merit Board, on the one hand, these are people that have the charge for overseeing the state police, law enforcement. And you have somebody like this running amok, playing politics, leveraging her relationships with the governor and his wife.
And when she, you know, was accused of an allegation, boom, the next day she accused Garcia of groping her, which was a lie and claims unfounded.
Bob in Edison Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, guys, going along with more of the problems in Illinois, how about the Republican Party in Illinois? Dan, I got to ask you. Has the Republican establishment or anybody in the higher reaches of the Republican Party, have they done anything really substantial for Darren Bailey at this point?
Well, I mean, there was a story yesterday that was at ABC7 and other outlets. The Illinois Republicans rally around GOP gubernatorial nominee Darren Bailey with focus on the November election. And this was at Gibson's where you got a bunch of the poobahs together and so on and so forth. And there was, more or less a kumbaya-ing going on. So that's something, it's something.
But do you see it as, you know more about this than I certainly do. What do you think they're going to basically give a half-hearted support of him? Or do you think they're really going to pull every the lever they have to try to get him in?
I think it will vary based on the individual. I think it will vary based on how well Bailey does. That is how close he can keep the race, you know, going beyond Labor Day into the final stretch. If, you know, you have a lot of the Republican establishment types that you're describing that are survivalists first and foremost, or at least they attempt to be, and they're not principled in any way, shape, or form. So if it's in their interest to stick with Bailey politically, then they'll stick with him. And if they perceive it not to be in their interest, then they won't. But I got to tell you, I'm sorry, go ahead.
One more quick point, and I'll let you go on that. But what I mean, I wish they were helping him at this point get to that point rather than, hey, let's see, you know, where the chips fall, whether we're going to back this guy or not. I mean, and, you know, this goes to everybody knows the problem in Illinois with the Republicans, but right now is when he needs their help. Right now is when he needs that extra push, and it just doesn't seem to be there. It's depressing. All right.
Thanks for the call, Bob. Well, I think it to some extent it's there. I think it could be more pronounced. It can always be more pronounced. I think Bailey needs to do a better job as a candidate as well. And of course, you're talking to somebody who backed him and right. is continuing to back him with the independent expenditure PAC that I run. He needs to be a better candidate. He needs to do a better job. There could be more pronounced support for him. There could be more courage exhibited by the Illinois Republican Party office holders. That's particularly in leadership, but that's always the case. That's been a forever lament.
Where are the rallies to support him with Jesse Sullivan and Richard Irvin and all the, you know, Gary Rabine getting behind Darren Bailey? Are we going to ever have that moment?
Well, I mean, I don't think there's acrimony. I mean, maybe with the exception of Irvin, but I don't think there's any particular acrimony. And Darren Bailey's from his comments at that event is moving on and focused on Pritzker, which is what he should be doing and where his focus should be. So, you know, I think the other good news, I mean, good news, bad news, because I didn't want him to leave. I don't want him to not participate in Illinois politics. That was never an intent. We just had there's this disagreement about who would be the best nominee. But, you know, with Ken Griffin's checkbook gone, Jim Durkin and Dan McConkey are in a bit of a pickle in terms of resources to support their state legislative candidates. And it is in their interest, and that's what this business is, aligning interests, not making friends. Their interests should be, if they recognize them, in flying in formation with Bailey and the backing that he has, at least as far as I'm concerned, through the IE that I run. If you want to have some of that support and the associated benefit down ballot, not just with the rest of the statewide slate, but also with state legislative House and Senate races, where there are, you know, a significant number of pickup opportunities, particularly if the environment nationally stays about where it is, and if Bailey can take proper advantage of it and, you know, keep the race tight going into the stretch and slug it out. Because it, as I said, from the outset, like from June 29th to present, this is going to be a war of attrition at best. That's just the nature of where the window is, what it looks like. Now, that can change over the next 14 weeks, but that's where it is today. Kevin, Austin, Texas.
How, you know, somebody who listens to the show and they get upset and they want to get involved, and, you know, we talk about as Catholics time, treasure, and talent. If you don't have any treasure, I don't want to cut a check. I don't want to do that. But if I want to get involved and support Bailey, what do I do? And what does it look like being a volunteer? Am I making calls? Am I walking streets? How does that work? And so for people who are listening who rightly get upset listening to you, they want to do something, and they want to support Bailey in that cause, what does that look like?
You know, I think you – thanks for the call, Kevin. Like you work through the campaign and allies of the campaign to – get involved with whatever aspect of the campaign you're more comfortable. Some people don't want to walk doors or can't walk doors. Some people don't want to make calls. They don't like making calls. So, I mean, there's all sorts of things that can be done. You can write friend-to-friend cards from the campaign, or you can write 100 letters to everybody that you know with an Illinois address. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you can do to find formation. Maybe there's a specific issue that particularly animates you, and so you want to be involved in, sort of the school choice coalition, for example, that's behind Darren Bailey because of his support for opportunity scholarships and Pritzker's opposition to said. So there's all sorts of ways, but you work through the campaign itself, and they will try to put square pegs in square holes, or through legislators or local elected officials or local organizations that that are interested in putting you to work too, if you're so amenable. I mean, it's just that simple, I think. Joe, Willow Springs.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Okay, listen, what my idea was is that, you know, how our buddy Mike Lindell from MyPillow has been cast out by so many of these horrific stores, and the liberals just hate him. Any liberal friend or relative you have to bring a gift to, I'd say buy some MyPillows and keep them on the side and give it to them for a gift. Well, if you don't see them go ballistic in front of you, you know they will eventually. But at least don't give them a receipt so they can return it. And this would be a great way to help Mike Lindell and MyPillow and really make a fool out of the liberals.
All right. Thanks for the call, John. Make sure to use the promo code Amy when you
exactly.
do that.
Yeah. A-M-Y.
Chuck and Delavan.
Chuck.
You're not going to believe this, but my grandfather, his name was Charles Laverty. He formed a union for the water department in Chicago. When I was 7 years old, he taught me when somebody gets up in your grill, just like that guy yesterday when he got up in a grill and tried to stab him, you immediately swing left or right as hard as you can, and it hits the bottom of their jaw, and it cuts off the blood to the carotid artery, and they'll drop like an ox. Okay. And I've seen it happen in my lifetime probably over 20 times. Not that I'm a ruffian or anything like that.
Of course
but
not.
That's a good move.
Circles you hang on.
No, I don't. I got a lot of bar time.
You're a lover, not a fighter. We know. That. Yeah, right.
Well, no. I said I do have a lot of bar time, though. But anyway, you guys have a great weekend. If you get a chance, come up to Venetian Fest. There's going to be a great band there on a Friday night. It's called Lunchbox Bullies, and they're good. Talk to you later.
Thanks, Chuck.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.